Time to take a look at the world of wildlife now with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Larry Mueller here. So happy to have you listening in. What have you been seeing lately in the outdoors in terms of wildlife? Do you have some questions about what you've observed or questions about events that are coming up? What about some of the disease issues that are affecting some of our wildlife? Scott Craven with us by phone today from the Kemp Experimental Station. Scott, are you with us?
I am here, Larry, and I'm just enjoying being up here and looking out the window here at the bird feeder and the beautiful day, and eagles are soaring, loons are calling. It's terrific.
Oh, it's wonderful, and the birds are singing.
Everything's very active. This is an incredibly busy month for wildlife, with the last waves of the insectivorous songbirds coming back, and of course, Migratory Bird Day coming up a week from Saturday. Fishing season opens on Saturday. Baby animals are starting to appear. The rest of the reproductive season is in full swing. It's really quite a neat month.
I had got an email from a friend yesterday who said he put his Baltimore Oriole feeder out with the grape jelly and the oranges, and in about an hour he had orioles there.
Wow, I guess I'll be heading back to Madison here tomorrow. It's time to get the grape jelly out then.
Yeah, I put mine up, this morning after seeing his email. I'm hoping I'm going to get a few of those as well. Wisconsin could gain about 11,000 acres of cropland set aside for wildlife conservation in a new provision offered by the USDA. Are you familiar with that one, Scott?
No, I'm not, Larry. Actually, in the conservation community, we would certainly welcome any opportunity to add some new acreage, but there's a lot of anxiety, actually, with the growing push for ethanol production and that kind of thing, that the need to put more, or the desire to put more acreage back into corn and that kind of thing, may actually put some pressure on land that's in conservation programs now, like the CRP program.
Yeah.
So anything that would add things is certainly a welcome provision, but I think there's a great deal more concern that it's going to go the other way.
Yeah. Scott Craven, our guest, if you would like to join in, let me give you the number finally, 1-800-642-1234. Or in Madison at 263-1890. Give us a call. Again, it's 1-800-642-1234, or in Madison at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions and comments, and we will be happy to get you on the air.
Have you had any rain down that way, Larry?
It's rained. Yeah, we had some rain, but not today. Today is a beautiful day. I think it looks like it's going to be beautiful across southern Wisconsin for the rest of the week.
Well, I have my snake catching field trip with my vertebrate ecology class this Saturday in southern Wisconsin, so a warm day would be most welcome. But we are very, very dry up here in the northeastern corner of the state, and some rain would be most welcome.
Well, I tell you what, we will send a little of it your way here.
If you could send us some rain, I'd be happy to send you a few problem bears that have been harassing us here around the station.
So getting into the bird feeders and such?
Well, I had one troublesome yearling bear last week that was extremely bold, would come right up to the windows, and the feeders, of course, I had to take down. But if you just cracked the window a bit to yell at him, he'd come right up and try and get in the window. And then while I was speaking in Green Bay last Friday, I got a call that he'd actually broken into the porch the night before and carried off a 50-pound bag of seed. So that was the last straw. So my friends and colleagues at USDA Wildlife Services brought over a culvert trap, and I got back and was home for about an hour before the bear was sitting in the yard, and then walked into the trap, out of the trap, into the trap, out of the trap, into the trap, and bang, the door went down, and he curled up in a ball and went to sleep, and he was relocated the next morning.
Right.
Only to have two much bigger ones show up that evening. So lots of bears around.
Steve in town of Burke has a question for you, so let's go to Steve. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks. Scott, I may have missed this on a previous program with Larry, but I wondered if you had a comment on the so-called audit that the DNR hired of a panel of distinguished wildlife biologists to evaluate the methods that the department has been using to evaluate the sizes of deer populations.
Well, yes, that audit committee reported in on what's called the sex, age, kill, or SAK estimate that the DNR has relied on for many years as kind of the backbone of their scientific management of the deer herd. And although it's, I think the issue is there's a fair bit of mathematics and yeah, somewhat difficult to grasp calculations that go into that. And as a result, because of that, and just because of the difficult nature of figuring out how many deer there are in any way, there's been a bit of skepticism about how that all works. But there have been periodic reviews of the SAK. They've all been supportive. And this most recent one, which consisted of some really top-notch people from around North America, I think validated the SAK or the techniques used as being both quite good and probably the best that are available in terms of figuring out what's going on with the state's deer herd and then making appropriate management decisions.
Hmm.
So this is yet another in a series of people taking a look at this particular issue and coming back and saying, hey, you know, this really does work. This is a good system. The one missing link, I think, that remains is to put the SAK into layman's language, plain English kind of approach, and give people a better shot at understanding how it's done and why it's done, and therefore hopefully building some support for the whole thing.
You know, I drew a somewhat different conclusion from it. The fact that they found, at least with the present size of deer management units, they were able to test theoretically for deer herds that largely matched the assumptions of the SAK model. Were not able to test for deer herds that didn't, but in the case of those that would, they found with the present size deer management units that, I don't know how to put this without putting it a little technically, the 95% confidence interval of the estimates, in other words, would show that 95% of the time the estimates could be off of the DNR, were actually published the figures, could be off by as much as 121% in either direction. And that's not leaving out the so-called deterministic bias, which might fluctuate from year to year. So it shows that at least they have to consolidate deer management units into much larger ones. And it also certainly did show that the SAK model is the most effective method that's currently available. But it seems to show that estimating deer herds is extremely difficult, and we're not going to have very accurate estimates or very reliable estimates for quite some time until a good deal of money is spent on research to improve overall those types.
Well, that's all very correct, and I think you're absolutely right in saying that what it did point out is that the tendency over recent years to add more and more deer management units, either because of metropolitan units or disease management units or anything that fragments units that were for a long time fairly stable, that's where the SAK estimates were the best.
Mm.
But as the unit histories change and either the regulations change, the unit boundaries change, it becomes increasingly difficult to make sense out of the information. So you're correct in that regard.
Thanks, Steve. I want to give some others a chance to get on here. Appreciate your call. Gail and Freedom, it's your turn next. Hi, Gail.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I have kind of a strange question.
That's our specialty.
No, this is our third year now that a couple years ago we heard a really odd bird, and we didn't know what it was until we spotted it and talked to another one of our neighbors, and it's a male peacock.
And boy, are they noisy.
Oh, yes, that's what I'm calling because, you know, of course now I can, you know, set my clock at 1:40 or 2 o'clock in the morning, and I swear it's outside my bedroom window, but it's actually probably 200 or 300 feet away. It, as far as we know, we're fairly close to Duck Creek, so it's got to stay there. Our one neighbor we know actually feeds it. It follows her around her yard.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, without the chance of actually getting a female to, you know, help, because I'm sure it's looking for a mate right now. I mean, I don't know. How is it surviving? It's not surviving in a building or anything. It's outside.
So you're suggesting that this is a essentially a feral peacock. I mean, it obviously had to belong to someone at some
Correct.
Point.
Correct.
And now it's an escape or it's on its own. And
right.
And they're quite, I mean, they certainly survive outside. People have them on farms as essentially, in a way, domestic fowl. They're certainly contained in lots of zoos and animal parks and so on. So they can get by, and especially as our winters get less and less severe, they get by even easier.
Mm-hmm.
The issue here is, I mean, the last thing we need is for a female peacock to find it and then all of a sudden have little peacocks and aggravate the problem. I mean, this is how we develop problems with exotic or invasive species.
Correct.
Now, peacocks certainly aren't on that list, but and they're beautiful, spectacular birds, but they're very noisy and annoying, often kept as kind of watchbirds, so to speak. So I think really the best thing that could be done for this bird and for your peace of mind and for the environment is to maybe work with your local DNR office and see about the possibility of capturing it.
Okay.
And getting it to someone who could take care of it and rejoin it with other peacocks.
Okay, I mean, that would be great, as I said, because it's hard to get a good night's sleep because that thing is certainly noisy.
Well, a peacock probably isn't very happy either.
Yeah, if it follows your neighbor around or responds to feeding or whatnot, it should not be difficult to capture, and it really belongs in captivity somewhere, not in the wilds of Wisconsin.
Yep.
Are there any predators? A couple weeks ago, we actually saw a bald eagle flying around the area.
I'm not sure an eagle would try and tackle a peacock. First of all, it would probably be completely baffled as to what that giant, colorful thing was. But certainly a coyote or a fox or something like that might turn it into dinner. And that's why I say for the bird's well-being and the well-being of a variety of other things, that bird should be back in captivity.
Okay.
Thanks
okay,
a lot.
I will contact him. Thanks for your help.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Nancy in Grafton, it's your turn next. Hi, Nancy.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, I like birds, but there's a light fixture 2 inches from my front door, and they want to build a nest behind the light fixture, and I don't want them there.
Yeah.
Am I justified in trying to discourage them?
Oh, certainly.
Okay.
I mean, it's quite common this time of year to have house finches, robins, and assorted other species attempting to nest on light fixtures and hanging flower planters and assorted other things.
And any hanging flower planter wouldn't bother me, but right outside my front door, and when I open the door, it scares them. And when they're done, I mean,
so
there's a lot of dirt on the wall and everything.
Well, that's another problem.
Yeah.
Swallows, if they're bringing in mud nests, will make a heck of a mess, and that's a problem I have at our front door. Mm-hmm. But certainly the thing to do is discourage them in the early stages of nest building so that they relocate. I mean, once the nest is constructed and then there are eggs in there, theoretically disrupting that nest or harming the eggs, the nest and eggs are as protected as the bird is.
I wouldn't want to do that, but last 2 weeks when I see twigs and things, I remove them, and they keep coming back.
Well, you might want to try some type of a covering that simply prevents them from coming back, and I'm thinking about some maybe heavy-gauge plastic that could be taped, just a piece of it that could be taped, duct taped, the miracle product, above the light so that it kind of drapes down over the light. I mean, make sure it's not a fire hazard, but some heavy plastic that might prevent them from getting to the site.
Never
or
thought of that.
Some
a little
sort
screening.
Of a plastic dome, you know, even a big plastic bowl that might fit over the light.
Uh-huh.
Anything creative. Not seeing the light, I can't really suggest something firm, but I think with a plastic bowl, a piece of plastic sheeting, some bird netting, plastic bird netting from the garden center could easily be draped over the light. There are probably a lot of ways that you could prevent them from access, and then you won't have to worry about the nest building at all.
I did try steel wool, but there wasn't enough of it, and it kept falling down.
Yeah,
I think you need something bigger that really drapes over the whole light fixture.
Okay, well, thank you so much.
Yeah,
okay.
Good luck, Nancy. Thanks for calling. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Keisha Mybrower, our on-air producer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking wildlife in Wisconsin today with Scott Craven. Join us if you have a question, 1-800-642-1234, the number to call, or in Madison at 263-1890. And we have some open lines we can get you on pretty quickly, 1-800-642-1234. And let's go to Judy in Milwaukee next. Judy, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm just calling because recently my husband and I were up north, just north of Green Bay, and we ran across a female bear with four cubs. And I'd always heard that bears only had one or two cubs, and so I was a little surprised to see four. Just how unusual is that?
That's pretty unusual. That's it happens. Two or three, you know, far more common, but there's always the extreme. There's the possibility that it might have been, there might have been an adopted one in there, so to speak, but chances are that was just an unusually big litter. So,
do you get any pictures?
For those of us being hassled by bears, that's not good news. They're reproducing like crazy.
So you got some pictures.
We got a couple of pictures of mom and one of the cubs, and it was so cute because they were crossing the street. They got separated. Three of the babies were on one side of the street, and they were peeking at us around the trees. It's so cute.
So they all appeared to be the same size and age and so forth?
Yeah, the three were the same, or the four babies were all the same eight size and everything. And then mom was pretty big.
It's like an unusually big litter, but it happens.
Scare them on over towards Scott. In Kemp, he needs more bears. Thanks, Judy. Oh, boy. Ken and McFarland, your turn. Hi, Ken.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I was just listening to the lady who called in a few minutes ago or a minute ago about the birds over the nesting at her light fixture outside her door.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, what we do here at our house, there's two things we do, is we turn the light fixture to the side a little bit if it's loose enough, or we've learned to put foil over it, and foil definitely keeps them away.
Okay, well, that's a good idea, and foil's very moldable and so forth, so that would be an easy covering.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate it, Ken. Yeah, wrap a little tin foil around it. Shirley in Waupun, hi to you.
Yes, are you there?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, I'm calling with the same answer, but it's a little different.
Okay.
The lady with the nesting birds above doorways.
Yes.
Okay. I had put plastic on, and that works fine. But I want to use my lights and not have a hazard.
Mm-hmm.
So all you need to do is hang up on the top of the light a stuffed animal.
Hmm.
Are you ready for that?
Stuffed animal.
Created. Creative. Yeah. A friend told me about this, and I have on my three lights, I have one over a patio door, one at the back door, one at the front door, and boy, I'll tell you, they take a look and they're gone.
Well, having a little beanie baby or something on the light is probably more attractive than a ball of foil anyway.
Yeah, that's true. But I just use a rubber band and you know.
What kind of stuffed toy do you use?
Well, I've got three different ones because I only I swiped the grandkids that left them in the basement. So I have a Garfield at the patio door.
I can see where that would do it.
Yeah, that's right. And I have at the back door a bear, a small bear.
Mm-hmm.
And at the front door I have a koala bear. I mean, it works.
Well, thank you very much for calling, Shirley, but stealing from your grandkids, I don't know about that.
Well, Nancy and Grafton should certainly have lots of ideas now, so if one doesn't seem to work very well, there are plenty more to choose from.
Yeah. Thanks, Shirley. Thanks a lot for calling. Blanca in Madison, it is your turn. Hi.
Hi. My mom lives up north in Wautoma, and I'm calling for her because she has something like a groundhog. It looks, you know, low to the ground and chubby.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a badger, but she's had it like for three summers. It comes and eats her vegetable garden and her flower gardens. And this summer, it showed up with a mate.
Uh-huh.
And she wants to get rid of them. She's tried scaring them, you know, putting things around her garden, getting a bicycle horn, and whenever she sees them, tooting them away.
Mm-hmm.
But she's afraid that now they're going to have babies, and this summer she wants to put out rat poison for them.
Not a good idea.
No.
Well, first of all, it's not like a groundhog. It is a groundhog or a woodchuck, same thing.
Yeah.
Very common problem and the bane of a gardener's existence when gardens are first going in. The key to successful groundhog control is to consult with an expert like Larry Mueller, the noted woodchuck trapper of Southern Madison. But the real issue is finding two things, either committing to live trapping and removing the animals as fast as they appear, or finding their burrow where their den site is, and it should be fairly conspicuous. They do a lot of digging. And then either catching them at the burrow, or there are ways the burrow can be treated so that they can be disposed of. In other words, there are ways to fumigate the burrow and other choices. Fencing and trying to live peacefully with them is not going to work very well. They're great climbers. They're even better diggers. So it's really a matter of removing them. If your choice is to remove them alive, they can be captured. And Larry really was very successful at removing woodchucks from his backyard with a baited live trap.
Nine of them.
If nine woodchucks, not nine traps. if you don't mind the notion that they're going to be controlled lethally or killed, which is legal on your own property, otherwise they're a protected animal, then of course in a rural area they could be shot if you have somebody in the family with a rifle who would be willing to do that. Or number two, as I indicated, there are gas cartridges that look like big firecrackers that can be ignited and then placed down the burrow, assuming you've found that, the burrow covered, and the animal is killed in its burrow. Some people don't like that idea, which is fine, but then you're back to the live trap and removal. But the bottom line is you're not going to be happy with a woodchuck around. If you're an avid gardener, they need to be removed.
She thinks that they may live in her barn. Would they live there?
Quite possible, yes. If it's an earthen floor, that's a very possible place for them to get in or under the barn.
You didn't address the rat poison, Scott. Maybe.
Oh, yeah. The issue is that it's simply not a legal application. There are very few poisons or toxicants registered in Wisconsin for wildlife control. There are certainly rodenticides available for rats and mice and ground squirrels and so forth, but as you get to larger animals, those poisons, while they might kill the animal, that's a dangerous and illegal application. And there are problems not just for the woodchuck, but for other species. And over the years on the program, we've heard of all sorts of horrendous uses of fly baits and other poisons to kill things like raccoons and woodchucks and so on. And that's risky for a lot of other animals, and it's not legal, and it's just not a good idea.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Good luck. Kyle in Russ County, it's your turn. Hi, Kyle.
Hello. How are you?
Good.
I got a problem. I got a porcupine that's hanging around my yard, and I don't want my dog to get it.
Mm-hmm.
So what can I use to bait this thing so I can relocate it? I got a live trap.
Well, I mean, handling a porcupine in a live trap, you better be careful if you're going to do that. But if that's your chosen tactic, certainly anything that's salty is a huge attraction to porcupines. Even a little piece of a salt block or a deer lick or salt block would probably work. But beyond that, fresh fruits and vegetables, maybe with a little salt on the side, you should be able to get them in there no problem. My advice would be to set the trap. Put some bait in it, but dribble some bait out from the trap and around the entrance to the trap. Wire the door open with a little twist tie or whatnot for a day or two to give the porcupine the sensation that, hey, this is a porcupine feeder. It's a free lunch. And once it's used to and you see what bait it really seems to like, then bait the trap heavily, enable the door by taking off the twist tie, and you'll have them.
Okay.
Okay?
All right, good luck.
All right, thank you.
Yep.
Thanks, Kyle. Bob in Milwaukee, on to you. Hi, Bob.
Hi, hello. I have a question. My daughter's working on her master's degree in entomology, so it requires her to go up north, northern Wisconsin, and this is her first summer, to go up there and set traps for beetles.
Yep.
But I'm a little worried about her maybe encountering a bear, so I'm wondering, I've heard about bear bangers, or if you have any advice as to what she should do if, in this situation if she does encounter a bear in the northern woods there.
You know, I just don't think there's a great deal to worry about. There's so much activity up here, human activity, and bears are quite numerous, and yet while you hear an occasional story, there was one, wasn't there one last year, Larry, about a Boy Scout or somebody at a campground?
2 years ago.
2 years ago, where there's an unfortunate incident, but really, 999 times out of 1,000 or more, the bear is long gone before you see it. And even if you do see it, you're kind of lucky to see one in the woods because they're far more concerned about you than you are of them. If you want to help her out, a few, I assume there are still copies around, but the Forest Service had a nice publication entitled Living with Black Bears that was just good, solid advice on, you know, how to handle food when you're camping, what to do if you see a bear, that kind of thing. If you can't get that, say, online from the Forest Service, then I would contact, or when she's up north, have her contact the USDA Wildlife Services office in Rhinelander, and they have an 800 number. In fact, I think I have the 800 number right here. Just a second.
And while Scott's looking, I would mention that probably the main danger is getting between the mother and her cubs.
Right. You don't want to do that. The 800 number for Wildlife Services, and they handle most of the nuisance bear work in the North Woods, is 800-228-1368. And I suspect they have some literature that she would find informative and useful. I think it's a very low-risk proposition, but if it provides, if having some information and some advice gives her some peace of mind, then so much the better.
And you some peace of mind.
Yes.
Yeah, that's for sure. She's going to be up there the whole summer.
No.
So, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Bob. Thanks a lot for calling. Scott, Scott in Madison would like to know why blue jays are less prevalent in Madison than, say, Chicago. I'm not sure that's the case, but...
I'm not sure that's the case either, Larry. I think that when an individual makes an account, and, you know, over the years we've had lots of calls, well, gee, there's no birds at my feeder, there's no birds in my backyard, I don't see this, I don't see that. But then when the rest of the listeners chime in and kind of enlarge the search area, it turns out there really is no problem. So I can't say what's going on here. Of course, blue jays are one of the species that presumably were affected by West Nile virus. There could be local areas where, you know, maybe there's an issue there. But for the most part, I'm not sure that the differential between Chicago and Madison is real.
Someone else wondered about the live traps in terms of controlling gophers.
If they're talking about the little striped gophers or ground squirrels, live traps are workable, but now you're dealing with an animal where there could literally be dozens of them in a backyard, and you're cutting yourself in by using a live trap to a lot of work, as opposed to using a rat-sized snap trap, which if you're okay with the notion that you're killing them rather than moving them, the rat trap is going to be many times more efficient and less effort than the live trap. And with the live trap, you, of course, have to move the animal where it may be a problem for someone else.
Yeah.
The animal itself, it may not be the most humane alternative to move this animal into an environment where it's perhaps the environment's already saturated with ground squirrels, or it has no shelter, is exposed to predators, et cetera, et cetera.
Dave in Minocqua, it's your turn. Hi, Dave.
Hi. I live in the Shawamigan National Forest between Park Falls and Minocqua. And a few years ago, we started noticing turkeys around our place, and now we got lots of turkeys.
Mm-hmm. I've got them outside my office window here in camp.
Well, I'm a grouse hunter,
mm-hmm.
and I love those birds. And I'm curious as to, number one, are turkeys indigenous to the country this far north? And number two, do they compete with grouse for anything? I mean, does the prevalence of turkeys inhibit the grouse population?
That's a common question, Dave, and it's not uncommon to hear what I'll refer to as tavern stories describing, you know, I saw a big old turkey eating grouse eggs the other day, or eating grouse chicks, or whatever. But that's simply... No, there's simply no negative interaction that up here in the North Woods I think you need to worry about. Grouse are on the upswing right now because of cyclic population behavior and so forth, and the fact that there are a few turkeys around is not going to make any difference to that.
Okay. Are they indigenous up here? I mean, 100 years ago, were there turkeys up here?
Turkeys were certainly a native species, but in years gone by when winters were more normal, if you will. A deep snow, very cold winter would take those turkeys out. So generally speaking, you know, central Wisconsin was considered the northern boundary for turkeys. The fact that they've expanded on their own and some have been moved up here over the last 5 or 10 years is a reflection of some fairly moderate winters. They could take it pretty hard if we do have a tough winter at some point. But for now, northern Wisconsin seems to be turkey range.
Okay, boy, my setter pup doesn't know how to react when she sees something like that.
Yeah, it's kind of a big flush in there. But, you know, people have been have kind of joined in the turkey hunting here now, and it's another recreational opportunity in the North Woods, although I admit it does seem strange to see them here in this habitat.
Well, that's great news. Thank you.
Thanks, Dave. Tom in Peshtigo, on to you now. Hi, Tom.
Hi. We have a cottage about an hour north of here, and there's a lot of logging roads going in the back, and they're sandy. And there's big holes in the sides of them, you know, where the ground goes up a little bit. I'm just wondering what's digging the holes and if there's something living down in there. They're like a foot to 18 inches round.
Well, it could be badgers digging up something for food. There are only so many animals that do primary excavation like that. Woodchucks, fox, badgers, maybe a couple others. But in terms of a lot of holes in an area that don't seem to be den sites, and certainly that close to the edge of a road isn't a very suitable den site, then badgers looking for something to eat is a reasonable explanation.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And Paul in Milwaukee, it is your turn. Hi, Paul.
I think it's Tom.
Oh.
That's all right.
Okay.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. I wonder if you could explain, several times now I have found raccoon dung on the top of my house, right next to the chimney.
Yeah.
What would cause an animal to climb to the top of someone's house to defecate rather than just on the ground?
Do you have a cap on your chimney, I hope?
No.
Well, if you don't have an animal-proof cap, I wouldn't be at all surprised if the raccoon's up there exploring the possibility of sharing your home with you by raising a litter in your chimney flue.
Oh, sweet. He's also on the top of my garage, and I have no chimney there.
Well, the raccoons are pretty dexterous, capable animals, and while there may be no chimney up there, I expect they explore every rooftop, house, garage, and everything else in the course of their nightly activities, either looking for something to eat or looking for a garage roof that may be compromised by a hole or some rot or something else where they can tear their way in and nest in there as well.
Oh, okay.
So I'm not saying they're spending a lot of recreational time up there, but they're certainly exploring the possibility of finding a den site in or on one of your buildings.
I'd be capping my chimney.
Yeah, it's nothing personal then, huh?
No.
All right, I'm going to get a cap on there right away. Thanks.
Well, before you cap that chimney, though, make sure you open your damper or flue a few times. Make sure they're not already in there.
Oh, good idea.
The last thing you want to do is cap the chimney and find out that either mom or the kids are already in there.
All right, will do.
Okay.
All right, good luck. Thanks a lot for calling. Scott, we had an email from William from an orchid hugger, he says. He has, he's talking about the deer herd in the 60s. It's moved from 0.6 million to 1.6 million.
Mm-hmm.
They're now eating rare flora, not just orchids, but a variety of other things, and wonders why has not an effort by the DNR been made to control the herd at the 60s level?
Well, I guess I'd have to take issue with the notion that effort hasn't been made. In fact, I think you could argue, Larry, as you well know as a deer hunter, that there's been a Herculean effort made to attempt to control the herd, not just because of their impact on the forest understory, agriculture, deer vehicle collisions, and certainly chronic wasting disease and other deer problems, but that effort has been made to reduce the herd by all sorts of regulations, liberalization, longer seasons, more permits. I mean, you know the litany of tactics they've tried to use, but the fact remains that the habitat is outstanding, the deer herd is prolific, hunters have been unwilling or unable to take the number of antlerless deer necessary to bring the herd down, and as a result, we see more and more hunting opportunity. Whether or not in some areas they're going to be able to catch up with that, I don't know. but winter has not done its fair share in recent years. And while hunters have taken record harvests since 2000, I forget how many records we've broken, I think at least three or more, and the harvest last year was close to 500,000, we need to take more. And the DNR knows that, and they're putting the tools in the hands of the hunters to do it. But if we don't or can't, the herd stays where it is.
Yeah. Yeah, and it is a problem in many areas.
It's clearly a problem, and the DNR is well aware of that, and they're certainly working hard in their disease control areas to push the herd back even lower than 1960s levels. But that's proving to be a very difficult task.
And we have an email from Melanie, who says that we have a lot of white-tailed deer here in the Jefferson-Helenville area. Mm-hmm. They don't have pink white deer. They don't have pink eyes, so I know they aren't albino. I have seen them together with white-tailed deer and was wondering what you could tell me about them, if they're white-tailed deer with some kind of genetic abnormality or if they could have been someone's pet that got loose, bred in the wild. And she also sent a picture of one. Very nice picture, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, I've been getting some email pictures of, I forget exactly now without going back on my email file here, a herd of deer that has, I think, four albinos in it, but these do look like albinos. They certainly could be, and there are true albinos. There are piebald deer or partial albinos that look more like Holstein cows with patchy white. And then I think this may get back to something we talked about earlier a couple of months ago, Larry, with this leucistic condition where a pigment is missing, but it's not necessarily the albinistic issue from a genetic standpoint.
Yeah.
But I do know that there's a, in fact, I just helped write a little testimonial for it. There's a new book coming out on albino deer in Wisconsin. A couple of well-known photographer up here in the Northwoods named Richter and John Bates, the well-known naturalist, have teamed up on this book, which I think is due out fairly quickly and is going to explore the whole subject and offer some, I think, terrific photography of these white deer. So I guess I would urge Melanie to watch out for that book and see if she can get her questions answered.
Good point. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking wildlife today with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Let's go right back to our phones, and Carrie in Reedsburg has a question for you, Scott. Hi, Carrie.
Hi there. How are you doing today?
Great. Thank you for calling.
Good. I have a question. I was wondering if you could identify a bird for me. I recently moved out onto 20 acres in New Lisbon, actually, and I have this very boisterous bird. He seems to be singing multiple different tunes, and it's hard to keep a record of when he's starting and stopping his tune again.
Mm-hmm.
He's more of a russet color, and he's got a longer fanned tail.
Hmm. Sounds like a brown thrasher.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's about the size of a blue jay, maybe, or
yeah,
a little smaller.
Yep.
Kind of rusty brown, a few spots on the breast.
Yep. It's not too big, or it's not too small. Yeah.
Yeah. Sounds like a thrasher.
Okay.
A pretty bird that you'd find in a rural area. Not especially common, but. Check a bird book, and I'm pretty sure if you go to a site like eBird on the internet, you can hook up to audio links
and
actually play a call from a thrasher and see if that's what you're hearing.
Fantastic.
And also, I should mention that Don Kruidsma will be on tomorrow's program, and he is the author of the book The Singing Life of Birds, and we'll be playing some bird songs tomorrow, as a matter of fact, on this program.
Okay, great.
There you go.
Thank you very much.
Thanks
and
a lot.
Larry?
Yeah.
As long as we're on that subject, we should point out that on Saturday the 12th is Migratory Bird Day.
Yes.
Which has been celebrated now, I think, since 1993. I think this is the 15th year in recognition of our many species of birds that migrate to and from Wisconsin for breeding season, winter, and so forth. And in celebration of that issue and the conservation of neotropical migrant birds, there'll be all sorts of bird festivals around the state over the next couple weeks. There's usually a big one at Horick, and I'm not sure what the date is for that one. But I know my colleague David Drake and I will be presenting backyard bird habitat programs at the what's the title here? I've got the brochure right in front of me, the Shawamigan Bay Birding and Nature Festival up at the Great Lakes Visitor Center in Ashland on the weekend of May 18th to the 20th. We're also doing similar programs at the Lakeland Discovery Center in Manitouish on Saturday the 19th. And I think there'll be a series of these festivals, workshops, birding trips, and so forth, all over the state. So for folks who are enthusiastic about birds, check their local papers and so forth for events that are coming up.
And I should also mention, on May 12th, there's a frog ecology workshop for the Sandhill Outdoors Skills Center.
Mm-hmm.
And Dick Thiel's in charge of that one. And I know people could email him at richard.thiel, T-H-I-E-L, at dnr.state.wi.us.
So the reality is, Larry, there are just dozens and dozens of opportunities for people to participate in natural history-related field trips, workshops, all sorts of things. The DNR magazine, an issue or two ago, had their annual lineup of field trips around the state, and I think there were 70 or 80 of them scattered around. The Outdoor Skills Center is offering these kinds of things, Tree Haven and Tomahawk, the Migratory Bird Day activities, the local Audubon societies. If people want to do this kind of thing, you could pretty much be going full-time, day and night, doing these kinds of activities, and you know, a lot of them are really neat.
Jim in Ashland, your turn now. Hi, Jim.
Good morning.
Morning.
I don't know, when we had warm weather up here about 3 weeks, a month ago,
mm-hmm.
out back over a field was a hawk. It was the wingspan was probably between 18 to 24 inches, and it was white on the breast, and the wings and the tips of the wings were brown, and the tail was white until the tip of the tail, which was brown too. And I tried to find it in a bird book. I couldn't come up with anything. It was middle of the day, sun shining, warm.
So you say that the base of the tail, there was a white patch on the base of the tail?
It was white. It just continued on, like, through the whole breast area all the way back through the tail feathers, and then there was the end of the tail feathers was brown, brownish.
Hmm.
Same with the tips of the wings.
When you mentioned the white patch, kind of a white patch on the tail is a distinguishing feature for a marsh hawk or harrier. Which would be out in daylight, kind of hovering over a field-like environment. I guess the only thing I can suggest you, I mean, you've apparently already done it, is kind of thumb through a field guide or bird book.
I did, and the closest thing I could find was like in Texas.
Well, strange things do happen. But I guess I'd urge you to go back and take a look at a marsh hawk and see if that might fill your bill.
I'll do that.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Walt in Middleton, your turn now. Hi, Walt.
Hi. See, I think I have squirrels in my attic. I think they got in through a louver. You know, it's an older house. And I'm wondering, I was thinking, they got in this winter, I think, and I thought they might work themselves out so I could put some kind of a mesh across or fix that louver.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering, you know, will they stay there in the summer, too, or what happens?
You know, once they're in, Walt, once squirrels have access to your attic, you're in for the long haul. When you say you thought they might work themselves out, they'll certainly come and go. But if they've got access to your attic as a den site, they're not going to leave on their own. So you're going to have to force them out, trap them out, or do something. The difficulty, and I've had lots of squirrel calls in the last few weeks, but what many people are worried about, and justifiably so, is whether or not there might be young ones in there that if you know, I can tell you how to put a squirrel excluder or a one-way door up on the opening so the adults can go out, but then are prevented from getting back in. But if there are young ones in there, number one, the adults will be frantic to get back in and may do even more damage to get back in. And number two, it's an inhumane way to deal with the young squirrels in terms of trapping them in there to die. So typically, squirrels in Wisconsin have two litters a year, usually one in late March, early April, and there's about a 6 weeks weaning period, so it's still possible that young squirrels could be in there, although they should be on their way soon. If you wait a couple more weeks, I think you've increased the probability that even if there are young squirrels in there now, that they're capable on their own of leaving if you do exclude them. And then you've got a window of opportunity before the second litter is normally born in midsummer. But the only other opportunity, if they're not, if you think you can put up with it or don't want to take the risk of trapping the young ones, if you hear them up there, you can always reopen whatever you cover the opening with, or you've got to wait until next fall when having young ones in there isn't a risk and deal with them then. But you're going to have to be proactive about getting them out. They're just not going to clear out on their own.
Yeah, and I'm wondering, do they eat like the covering on electric wires?
If you shave the hair off the tail of a squirrel, you have a very good representation of a rat. And some people refer to them as tree rats. They're just as capable in terms of gnawing, climbing, and everything else, and they will damage your insulation. They will damage the wiring in terms of the insulation, and before I meant your thermal insulation. And they can chew up woodwork to get in and out. And in addition, if you have acoustical ceiling tiles and they have access to those, they'll chew their way through those as well. So all I can tell you is a squirrel is not an animal you want to share your house with.
Okay.
But you need to be a little bit cautious that you don't exacerbate the problem by trapping young ones inside.
I think they actually came down into one bedroom. You know, they didn't get in the room because I keep that room shut. So they, you know, but the insulation had come through a hole, so they were probably pretty close.
Yeah.
Well, they can be very destructive, so I urge you to get them out and build them out.
Thanks, Walt. Good luck. Appreciate it. Steve in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Larry. How are you today?
Great. Thanks for calling.
I've got another bird ID question. I was sitting at my desk about 2 weeks ago, and my chihuahua was running around in the backyard. And I look up, and not 10 feet off the ground on a branch is a bird that I initially thought was an immature bald eagle. It was about the same size as an eagle, except it was light gray, and it had longer legs than an eagle has, with kind of those pantaloon feathers, you know, on mm-hmm. the legs. And I can't figure out what it is. I've asked a couple people, and, you know, I know what an eagle looks like, and this wasn't an eagle, but it was about the same size. Is there a really large hawk that's around this area? And this is downtown on the west side in Madison.
Well, there are some pretty good-sized hawks that would appear gray, including Cooper's hawks or even a goshawk, although it's more likely a Cooper's hawk in a suburban environment. But I, you know, and maybe if they were up close, you could, they're a big bird, but certainly not eagle size. There's no hawk that, not that we have around here, that truly approaches the size of an eagle. But that's an eagle at close range like that is a huge bird. The hawks would be large enough, but not eagle size.
It looked the size of an immature eagle, which are even bigger than the mature one. So it was a really big hawk.
Well, I'm not sure what to say. The adult males of a couple of those hawks I mentioned are grayish in color, and they would have the feathering on the longer legs that are typical of a bird-eating hawk, like a Cooper's hawk or a goshawk, but they really don't. If in a side-by-side comparison, they don't approach the size of an eagle.
But could have been a Cooper's. That's probably the most likely, Steve.
I would, if I were you, I'd, again, either online on a site like eBird, excuse me, or utilizing a field guide, thumb through and see if there's anything that, you know, when you see it, it jogs your memories. Aha, that sure looks like it. And then the dimensions will be there in the field guide, and you can see if that matches up by comparing it to the perch you saw it on or whatnot.
Mm-hmm. Good luck, Steve. Thank you for calling. Dee in McFarland, hi to you.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Well, I have a Cooper's hawk that hunts my backyard.
Uh-huh. Yeah. you and lots of other folks.
Yeah, well, I live out on the shore of Lake Wabisa.
Mm-hmm.
And we're saving a lot of money on birdseed.
Yes, if the Cooper's hawks move in, the birds tend to lie low or
yep.
disappear or get eaten.
And last summer I saw a confrontation between a young hawk and a squirrel.
Mm-hmm.
They faced off, and the squirrel sat up on his hind legs and puffed his tail out, And let me tell you, that hawk backed right off.
A squirrel is, it would be really a problematic tackle for a bird like that.
Yeah, well, I think he was just learning.
Yeah.
Well, and a Cooper's hawk, a full-grown Cooper's hawk, up close, is, we had them in our backyard, too.
Uh-huh.
And they look pretty darn big.
Yeah, they're pretty formidable. Mm-hmm. When they sit in your bird bath, it's like a whale in a pail. Now, can you tell me anything, is there anything to deter them? We would like to see the birds back again. Is there anything we can do to protect the birds from them or get the hawk to move on?
Unfortunately, probably not. What we usually tell most folks is if they've had one come in, it depends a little bit on whether the bird's just using your property as a convenient and productive hunting spot or whether they've actually got a nest somewhere in a big evergreen nearby or what have you. But anyway, certainly the first step is to cease and desist on the bird feeding.
For a while.
And for a while, anyway. Let the songbirds disperse. And as they disperse, and therefore there's no concentration or no easy pickings for the Cooper's hawk, then you have to hope that that bird will move on.
Yep. And hope you can. You have nothing but hope at this point. And we have nothing but no time. So we're going to take a look at the news, and we'll be right back with Scott Craven. Stay with us. Talking the world of wildlife today with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Thanks for listening in. Appreciate it very much. Lots of people online, so we'll go right back to our phones and to Bill in De Pere. Bill, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Thanks for calling.
I volunteer at the local botanical garden, and we have quite a bit of vole and ground squirrel damage, particularly voles in the wintertime with these exotic plants. The obvious solution, I suppose, could be to try to poison them, but there's some concern that other animals, particularly raptors like hawks, might eat the bodies and also get poisoned. First, I guess the question would be, is that a valid concern? And second, would you have any other tips so far as controlling these critters?
Well, vole damage is vole or meadow mice, as many people call them, a stubby little short-tailed rodents, so everybody knows what we're talking about here. Their damage is usually done, the most of the damage is done during the winter when they're operating beneath the protective blanket of snow and either digging through the grass, taking the bark off a variety of ornamentals and shrubs and so forth, and that's when the damage occurs. So by this time of year, the voles have usually retreated from that habitat into denser grass vegetation, vacant lots, ditch banks, natural areas, that kind of thing. So they're more difficult to control now. The key time to get after them is in the fall of the year before snow flies. And at that point, depending on the scale you're talking about, you can do make some great inroads into the vole population with a grid of snap-type mouse traps or with the rodenticides that you were describing. But I think depending on your rodenticide selection, there are products available, particularly anticoagulants, which pose relatively little risk of secondary poisoning to raptors, cats, and that kind of thing. And the bait can usually be applied either in bait stations or beneath a piece of shingle or board or something like that where the voles will have access to it, but nothing else will. It's difficult to bait them during the winter, although I have seen bait stations manufactured out of PVC pipe, maybe 2 inches in diameter, where you put a T, essentially create a T with a couple of joints, so that there's a horizontal piece, perhaps a foot or 15 inches long, that would rest on the ground, and then a vertical piece that comes up from the center of that, and you can cap the vertical piece. So with these things staked in place, you can go along during the winter, unscrew the cap, and place your rodenticide, just pour it in the vertical piece, and it goes down and is then available in the tube along the ground that the mice will find their way into. So there are some alternatives, but the bottom line is timing is everything with meadow mice, monitoring their populations so you know if it's a good vole year or not, and they tend to cycle on roughly a 4-year rotation in terms of population abundance, and then knowing how to deal with them are the keys to success with that.
And with the anticoagulants such as Decon or Warfarin, poisoning other animals is not that might pick up the body and eat it isn't a great consideration?
No. No, it's not. And there are products available. There's one called Volid, for example, V-O-L-I-D, that's manufactured specifically for vole control. And so I think if you do a little homework on the Internet or with a local farmer's co-op or whatnot, you can find a product that will be relatively safe from a secondary poisoning standpoint and will do the best job on your vole control.
Yeah.
And then the other part of it is properly placing the bait so it's not an immediate risk to birds or other animals.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for calling, Bill. Appreciate it. And Lisa in Madison, your turn. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. When do cormorant chicks, when do they hatch?
Cormorant chicks.
Yeah.
Let's see, what are we at, the 1st of May? I'm just trying to think back onto the hatching chronology on some of the islands in Green Bay where we were working a couple of years ago. They're usually back in April, May. I'm going to say from any time possibly, depending on the phenology of the year, from mid-May on into June.
Okay.
Why, have you seen some hatched already?
No, I'm just wondering for Cathedral of the Pines. That's where I go.
Oh.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
In terms of seeing them or to see them?
Yeah, that's way up by...
It's on Trout Lake, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that, you know, I've got... So is there a nesting colony there?
Yes, in the White Pines.
Oh, I'll be darned. Well, yeah. I'll have to go over and have a look. That's probably not 10 minutes. What's that?
It's not good for the public to know, though.
well, in any event...
Too late for that.
Yeah.
I may check that out, but I think it's still a bit early for up here, but further south, obviously, earlier.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. And Bob in Black River Falls, hi to you.
Good. How are you guys doing today?
Great.
Great.
I got a question about feral pigs. I'm from southeastern Ohio, and the terrain is pretty much similar to up here in Wisconsin. Why is it that when domesticated pigs get loose that they revert so quickly back into the wild?
Well, interestingly enough, an awful lot of animals, when they get into the wild, revert rather quickly to wild behavior, but pigs do seem to be pretty quick about it. Maybe they're not particularly domesticated in the first place. I guess I'm not sure how to answer that question except to say that, yes, when pigs, even what you'd say might be a domestic pig in a feedlot one day, gets loose and becomes quite capable of taking care of itself and rooting around in the wild in a very short order, that's true, but I can't give you an explanation for that.
Oh. All right. Thanks for calling. Say, we got an email from Lynn, who is interested in creating a reptile habitat. She says we have bits of concrete, rocks, and branches, and we need advice on where to locate this habitat. Our land has woods, prairies, and hillsides for possible locations. Also, would it be best for the habitat to face south?
I guess in terms of reptile habitat, we have to consider which reptiles they're interested in. And there's obviously a big difference between, say, turtle habitat and snake habitat. But since they're talking about the bits of debris and cement blocks and things like that, I'm assuming we're talking snakes. And in that case, it's either a matter of wherever in a habitat, particularly at edges where, say, prairie meets woods, brush meets prairie, that kind of thing, that would probably be a good location for anything from brush piles to whatever cover they can create with whatever materials they have. In terms of utilizing construction materials like cement blocks or other things that they may be trying to get rid of or simply have available to dictate or devote to this purpose, creating what's called a snake hibernaculum is something that can be done. And there the location may be determined by having an appropriate site where there's already some rock or outcropping present, so the snakes are already associated with the area, again on edges where there might be more of a movement corridor, or a piece of low ground that needs to be filled in, something like that. And certainly these animals are concerned, reptiles are very concerned about heat, so an area that has southern exposure or more sunlight is more open, less tree canopy is going to be better than a closed area. So those are some of the considerations. There are actually plans or designs for creating a snake hibernaculum in the Minnesota book Landscaping for Wildlife. So I would urge Lynn to maybe consider a copy of that, which would help in other considerations besides just the structure or configuration of the hibernaculum. Now, if it's turtles on the reptile front, then obviously there the big concerns are water sites for the aquatic turtles, basking sites that can be created with half logs, nesting beaches, and other kinds of features. So that's
okay.
The Reader's Digest version on that.
And there's one here that I could answer on email about a story yesterday about a beetle that could wipe out our ash trees within 20 years. And Mike in Mineral Point was wondering, is it the emerald ash borer, or is there also another potential insect threat to our ash trees? And I'm pretty sure that story had to do with the emerald ash borer. I don't know of another insect that is creating the kind of publicity that the emerald ash borer has gotten.
That seems to be the big one.
Yeah.
Larry, as long as that reptile habitat issue came up, I just wanted to point out that this is the time when people are starting to head to their garden centers and think about spring planting in terms of garden, shrubs, landscaping, wildlife habitat, and so forth. I guess I'd just like to put in a plug to try and incorporate wildlife concerns in that landscape planning in terms of thinking about trees or shrubs that provide either particularly good cover or a food resource in the form of nuts, berries, or other fruits. Think about that kind of thing to incorporate in your landscaping. And in particular, the other aspect of this when you're planning a new landscape or a new garden is to be proactive in thinking about how to protect those plant materials from deer, rabbits, voles, moles, and assorted other animals that can cause some garden or landscape problems. So think about the fencing up front. Think about how you're going to apply repellents. Think about placement, all those kinds of things.
All right, and we can take some more calls here, and let's go to Carol in Brookfield next. Carol, hi to you.
Hi. We have a large deck on the back of our house, and we have a mother fox and four babies under there. We've seen the babies, and we've seen the mom. Now, we were out in the nice weather on Sunday, and we heard the babies all day, and now we've not heard them since early Monday morning. Do you think she took them and went elsewhere because we were out, or did she take them to another part of the deck? And do we need to do something just to keep her out of there permanently? My husband was going to take the planking off the deck. And we have been working with someone who would trap them and humanely relocate them, but we're just wondering, what should we do?
Well, I guess one possibility in terms of their apparent disappearance is that I don't know when they first appeared, in other words, when they were born, but it may have been at the point where she was ready to move them anyway.
Okay.
And they're off with her.
Yep.
It may also be as the weather's gotten better and your own activity has picked up, as you suggested, that you're now out using the deck and using the yard. She may have just decided, things are getting just a little too busy around here, and she could very well have moved the litter to an alternative den site.
Okay.
Which may not have anything to do with your deck or even your property.
Okay.
So if it goes a few more days and it appears that they've simply left the area, then so be it. You can assume that they're off and thriving somewhere else, which is fine.
Okay.
In terms of stopping the issue from happening again, I would certainly wait before you start to think about skirting or screening the deck to make darn sure they're out of there so you don't trap anything inside.
Yeah.
But ultimately, later on in the season, the thing to do is to skirt that deck with welded wire, with something as large as a fox. You could use a pretty large mesh welded wire. But in order to solve other problems like skunks or woodchucks or anything else that might come there, a smaller mesh might be a little more advantageous, and you're going to have to trench that down a little bit in the soil and flange the bottom of it. So if you dig a trench, it has to be wide enough to accommodate a maybe 4 or 5 inch bend in the wire so that it bends out away from the deck. Mm-hmm. So any animal that hits the wire and decides, I'm going to dig down and get under this, they may dig down a foot or however deep you've buried it, but then they're going to hit that flange, and they won't dig back and out and around it. So okay. You don't have to bury it as deep as you would otherwise if you can dig enough of a trench to put that flange on. But that's okay. Really the only way to prevent access from a variety of animals under a deck.
Okay.
Do you think the fox will come back next year?
It certainly might.
Yeah,
But if the deck is skirted, it's going to find another den.
Yep. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Say, Scott, Melanie's husband called back. Melanie had...
the snake, the reptile.
No, actually, no. the white deer.
Oh, okay.
And wondered about the name of the book. You mentioned a book.
Yes, and I do not know the actual name of it, but the author's, the photographer's name is Richter, and some of the writing was done by John Bates, and I just don't have access to the title right now. I'm not sure I ever knew, but... It should be coming out shortly, and it deals with albino deer in the North Woods.
Okay.
That's all I can tell you right now.
And Bill in Lancaster says he's heard rumors of a big cat making its way to Lancaster and wonders if it might be a cougar, and if you've heard this, and if so, was it released by the DNR?
Well, I've not heard that particular cougar story, but I can assure you that it was not released by the DNR, if in fact there's a cougar at all. That's not something that would have been done. But we'll add this to our long, long list of cougar sightings or encounters or experiences. It's certainly possible. There are an increasing number of reports that are being tracked by both the DNR and a group of students at UW-Stevens Point. And, you know, we long since gave up on the notion of resisting the thought that there were cougars in Wisconsin. There clearly must be some, but their origins still remain cloudy, and I can't comment on this particular one except to say I know it wasn't released by the DNR.
They have never released a cougar.
They have never released cougars in Wisconsin and probably never will.
Sally in Middleton, it's your turn. Hi, Sally.
Hi. Hello. Thank you. I got those darling little pair of rabbits in the backyard, and boy, do they love everything growing out there.
Mm-hmm.
What do I do? I've got a live trap, but they just ignore it.
Well, it's getting late in the year for live traps to be very successful for two reasons. Number one, pretty soon your whole yard will be a smorgasbord, so it's
right.
Hard to bait them into the trap.
Right.
And number two, they've probably already had at least one litter and are probably working on a second and a third, so there'll be lots of little ones around. And therefore, you've kind of missed the big window of opportunity in late February or March where they're very vulnerable to trapping. You can still increase the acceptability of your trap by potentially covering it, wrapping it with some type of material so that it appears tunnel-like. They may enter it then just for the sense that it's shelter. You can try some different baits, or fresh carrot and apple and so forth, to try and entice them in. Or you can be very judicious in where you place the trap, where you see the rabbits, or along a break in a fence or a runway or some other obvious point that they have to pass through that would therefore guide them into the trap. You can even put up some little lengths of chicken wire or something like that to direct them into the trap. But I think at this point that trapping is going to be minimally successful, and you better start to think about fencing or otherwise protecting whatever you don't want them to get.
Okay. Thanks, Sally. Ernie in New Richmond, your turn. Hi, Ernie.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
Or I should say good afternoon at this point. I guess my call-in is a little different here, but, you know, I'm seeing a little bit more of a disconnect with the youth involvement with our outdoors.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I feel that we all really need to start participating and making sure that we're getting our youth out and getting them involved in the habitat. And I've got a group of young boys that have been working with me, and we've been doing a lot of cleanup, a lot of trash pickup, which is really a shame. But, you know, could you comment a little bit on maybe some programs that may be available for some of the areas to use some youth involvement?
Sure. I think that you've touched on what I think is maybe one of the biggest problems in conservation, wildlife, and just generally protection of the outdoors that's currently something we should deal with. And first thing, I'd refer both you or anybody else who is sensitive to this to a wonderful book that's been attracting a lot of attention by Richard Louv, L-O-U-V, and it's called Last Child in the Woods. And if you haven't seen that book, I suggest that you you take a look at it, because it speaks to exactly, and in great detail, exactly what you're talking about. And Richard Louv coined a phrase called the nature deficit disorder. And he develops that thought and concept in the book, that kids today don't have the opportunities that perhaps, you know, Larry and I and you had to play outdoors. Either the parents perceive there's some risk associated with that, or there's simply no place to play outdoors that isn't paved or off-limits or whatever. So kids are not outside catching tadpoles and lying in the fields and just doing the climbing trees, doing the kinds of things we did. And that is his fundamental argument, is that's what's created this nature deficit disorder. And the real issue is, if kids are not brought up understanding and appreciating and developing a love for nature, that it's going to become increasingly difficult to protect those values as time marches on. So anything anyone can do, from working with your own kids, that's where things start here. Your own kids, your grandkids, take them to a nature center, take them out for a walk in the woods, just get them outside and away from the video games and computer screens, and let them experience all the wonders of nature. Get them a butterfly net. Just let them go outside. You know, those kinds of things. That's where it all starts. In a more organized way, you know, 4-H groups, scouts, those kinds of organizations, all the different workshops and field trip opportunities that Larry and I were talking about earlier on the program, you know, anything that gets the kids outside to experience nature will in the long run help. So I'm glad you brought that up. And don't forget that book, Last Child in the Woods. It'll scare the heck out of you.
And is it is that a recent book, Scott?
It's fairly recent. Louv is still kind of on tour promoting the book. I think it's been out for a couple of years, but it's really pretty scary stuff. One of his quotes, if we have just 10 seconds here,
sure.
Larry, is interviewing a little kid, I think the 10-year-old boy in San Diego or somewhere, and Louv's question to the child was, you know, it's a beautiful day, you know, why not go outside and play? And the boy's response was, well, no, I don't really want to play outside. Well, why not? Well, so all the electrical outlets are in here. And, you know, that's the kind of thing that we're up against. The kids don't have any frame of reference for being outside or entertaining themselves, playing tag or chasing butterflies or whatever. And Lou's contention is that that's not good for the kids in terms of their developmental health, and it's in the long run, and it's certainly not good for the environment.
I'm going to have to get him on the show.
He would be a terrific guest. I heard him speak as a keynote at a conference in Oregon a couple months ago, Larry, and he'd be a terrific guest.
I've just made a note of that. We'll get him on.
Okay.
And Shirley in Milwaukee, a quick question?
I just had a suggestion. You were talking about the deer overpopulation.
Mm-hmm.
And I have two cousins who live out of state, so they're non-residents. But they own land in Wisconsin, and they'd both like to deer hunt.
Mm-hmm.
But it's too expensive. I think if they'd lower the out-of-state license fee, especially for people who pay taxes in Wisconsin.
That would help. What do you think, Scott?
Well, it's certainly a possibility, although there's a long heritage for trying to give residents a break over non-residents. And the disparity in western states, as you well know from hunting, Larry, has gotten worse rather than better. And, you know, I guess while I think I'm not sure what a non-resident license is right now, Larry, $100, $150?
Something like that, yeah.
I don't know. It's still, even at that, given the cost of everything else for the recreation involved and the potential meat and so forth, still doesn't seem like such a bad deal. But that's a DNR decision, not ours.
And, Scott, our time's up. Thank you so much for being with us. We'll look forward to your next visit. By the way, somebody said, Leslie says you should be on more often. She emailed in.
Well, I appreciate that sentiment, but, you know, a month seems to be just about right.
Thanks, Scott.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest. Tomorrow, Don Krudzma talks The Singing Life of Birds and his book. Thanks for listening. Stay with us.